is it about the mouths that exposes people?
The facial expressions that we make over and over again get etched into our skin. We're born with the ability to make microexpressions.
Annie Thornblad.
She's the human lie detector.
She reads micro expressions.
You're a globally recognized speaker and strategic advisor to some of the most powerful human beings in the world.
The micro expressions are hardwired into us in the same way that humans sweat when we're nervous, cry when we're sad.
What are some of the micro expressions that have kind of surprised you?
That's a really good question.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Today, we have Annie Thornblad on the show. She's a micro expression specialist certified in the facial action coding system and can numerically code the 10,000 muscle combinations in human expression. She's also the author of The Diary of a Human Lie Detector and the Facial Expressions Glossary. And she has over 25 years of experience living in 9 different countries while studying 8 languages through immersion. Welcome to the show, Annie. Really excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited too.
Yeah, we had a bit of a chat just before this around the countries that you lived in and the languages that you've immersed in. And while this isn't a language learning podcast, but more of a micro expression, conversation, I wanted to actually dig in kind of as a way to talk about that is, out of all of these countries that you have immersed yourself into with the languages, what are some of the micro expressions that have kind of surprised you when living in these cultures?
Okay, so that's a really good question. I'm trained as an anthropologist, so I have a master's in anthropology. I expected to be spending my life digging into the differences in cultures. I'm a linguist. I've studied 8 languages, most of them through immersion. I'm fascinated with languages. So that's why we got kind of off track. We started a little late because I wanted to nerd out with you about languages because I saw your companies that you built. Fascinating, so exciting. But I guess what's really surprising to me is that I ended up working with the pieces of humanity that are universal to our species. The micro expressions are hardwired into us in the same way that humans sweat when we're nervous, we cry when we're sad, the blood pumps into our fists when we're angry so that we can fight, our lips tighten, everything clenches when we're angry. When we're scared, the blood rushes down to our legs and our feet so that we can run. Our hands get cold. That's why our hands get cold when we're when we're scared. When we're aroused, men have erections. The blood flows to the middle of their body. See, that's where I got the funny micro expressions on your face. It's a little unexpected.
I'm talking about erections.
I'm like, what? Wait, who? Yeah. Huh? But it drives the point home that arousal leads to a change in blood flow and muscle movement. We know that as humans, we wouldn't survive as a species were that not true. And in our eyes, our pupils dilate when we're aroused. So for each emotion, there's a change in blood flow and muscle movement that's different from one emotion to another in our bodies and on our faces. And so when you look at the cultural differences, there are what we call punctuators. So for example, in Italy, they do a lot of, that kind of Al Pacino. Yeah, I don't know about that, or I'm not so impressed, or like a man looking at a woman who's really attractive, he might go, not bad. So that's a facial expression that we all make, but they may use it a little bit differently. But most of those, and that's used as a way, like specifically, almost like a piece of language, like, and it's held, and it's often with like a shaking of the head, or nodding of the head, and so. The facial expressions that I generally teach are the ones that are universal because those are the ones that, for whatever reason, tickle my obsession. And I think those are the ones that are most useful. And for, you said you were in Vietnam right now. For those of us who are kind of more nomadic, where we just we're just always itching to travel and to meet new people. And when we go to new countries, we often just don't speak the language. So we're completely reliant on the facial expressions, the gestures, the tone of voice. And tone of voice can be hard when you're first learning a language. But the micro expressions, the facial expressions are always the same. And they're hardwired into us even if we're born blind. So it's a genetic thing. Yeah. So it's so juicy and interesting. And you and I were talking a little bit about language before we started. And I was saying that I went to Sweden when I was 16 on a Rotary scholarship for a year and lived with a host family. And everybody kept telling me, well, you know, you can't learn Swedish. That's a really hard language. It's hard to learn when you're 16. If you were two, you'd have learned it. And I thought, if I was a baby and born in Sweden, I would have learned Swedish. So in my head, the capacity was there and the problem was the English. The problem that there was already a language taking up space, almost like you can't fall in love with one person if you're obsessing about another. So I thought, I just removed the English from my head. So I refused to think in English and I learned the phrase bara svenska, which means only Swedish. So anytime anybody would speak to me in English, I was kind of a pill.
Full immersion.
Bara svenska. Yeah. Yep. And then I just, you know, I watched Swedish TV. I listened to Swedish at the dinner table. I went to a Swedish gymnasium, which is high school. And I just listened and I would sit there bored out of my mind and I would count the word ok, which means and. Mm. But I didn't know that meant and. I just noticed that people were going, blah, 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 ok, ok. So I would just kind of pass the time, but do exactly what babies do and immerse myself in the boredom, and then the neural pathways just eventually find a way. But I spent years and years of my life not understanding what people were saying. So I got really, really good at the nonverbal stuff. And I was motivated because the boys were really cute. I wasn't know what they were saying.
Probably what got you there in the first place, right? Like, why Sweden? It's so cold there. I mean, come on.
I know it's cold, but they warm you up.
No worries. It's fascinating. So you said most of the focus of your work is universal micro expressions, but if you were, it's fascinating that blind people can also have these expressions, right?
Well, think about it. Blind people have erections, right? Like we're programmed. Right. They sweat, they cry, we have physiological responses that differ to each emotion.
Right. But my thought process, though, is that an erection is something that is just like a natural thing that you don't mirror someone else doing. Whereas if I'm smiling, maybe I grew up because my parents were smiling and I'm
mirroring.
I mean, that's my hypothetical bro science, non-experience thought process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you're talking about the mirror neurons. But the question is, do we get sexually aroused? I mean, it's contextual. But do we get sexually aroused when we notice that someone else is sexually aroused?
True.
Right? If you're attracted to that person, right?
I mean,
arousal is interesting because, yes, it does depend on the person. And some of us are more attracted to more people than others are. And so there's this huge spectrum there. But we used to believe in science that the motion came first and then the muscle movement happened. And I was just talking about this the other day that, have you watched Big Bang Theory?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah. So Amy Farrah Fowler has a sentence that I just watched over and over again where she's sitting in a car and she says, yes, this is so exciting because what we're proving is that the muscle movement precedes the moment of consciousness. And so I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically, we found that the muscle movement in the facial expression precedes the moment of understanding and interpreting. So if we freeze the muscle movement, if we cannot make that muscle movement, we impair the process of emotional thinking and feeling. So the muscle movement comes first, here's disgust, and then it sends a message to our amygdala. We process it. We figure out how I'm feeling. And because we're mirroring the other person, how that person feels. It's how we think and process emotion. Hmm. It's like when you touch something really hot. So I've got a coffee cup. I actually have tea in here. It's like I lived in Asia for 12 years. It's like a ginger, turmeric, honey, lemon, because my throat is hurting a little bit with garlic, chopped garlic. It's like a whole thing.
Very healthy. Yeah.
Right. And so, but if it's really hot and I touch it, and imagine this is like a hot pot on the stove. I'm not going to leave my hand there and go, oh my goodness, this is so hot. I better, like, I think my skin's burning up. The first thing I'm going to do is move my hand away and go, what just, ow! The ow comes after the movement. Right. And it's the same with the facial expressions. So I use it to help me think. My day job is strategic advisory, and that's what I did for 2 decades across Europe and Asia. Worked with boards and CEOs and management teams, and I kept my ability to code secret. I never told anybody, and really, I had four adults that knew. My children, you know, I trained every day, but only 4 grown-ups knew.
Wow. And when you're talking about these universal micro-expressions, like how much of the way we express it today, what would you say, I mean, approximately, of course, what would be the approximate of nature versus nurture? Like, what are the things that we grew up maybe from a culture perspective? Like you said, Italians mm-hmm. express themselves a certain way. Japanese people mm-hmm. probably express themselves a different way. What percentage out of it is just something that we were born with that we all express versus things that are culturally kind of molded into us as we grow up?
Okay, great questions. There's multiple questions in that. So I'm going to try to break them up. We're born with the ability to make microexpressions unless we have facial paralysis, unless there is some medical difference in us. We are born to make the macro and the micro expressions. We can be socialized to be more expressive with the macro, with the bigger expressions. So I define macro expressions. I believe Paul Ekman talks a lot about that. He's the person that has done the broadest body of academic work in the field of micro expressions. He's a genius. He doesn't necessarily explain it in a way that's super simple and translated, which is my strength. And so he talks about the macros, I believe, as being like 1 to 4 seconds. So if I make the macro of disgust, it's got 3 main pieces. It wrinkles the sides of the nose, deepens the nasolabial furrow. I just call this the nostril shadows because I like to simplify to teach. Yeah. And it lifts the upper lip. Ew. It actually shuts off the nasal passage. If we smell something disgusting, we humans do. Ooh. We even tuck in our chin to shut off our throat. Mm. So the you may live in a family that's extremely expressive, where you're all kind of like, oh, are you going to make that again? Are you going to, you know, and there's little anger and frustration and problem solving. And can we fix this? Can we eat something else for dinner here? Or you may live in a family where you're trained not to make those facial expressions. I did a lot of high stakes negotiation in various parts of Asia. The poker face ability for a lot of
businessmen. I was just going to say, this is how I grew up. Like Asia, it's 0 expressions.
We're not showing it. And it's, you know, it's exemplifying some of the values where there's some stoicism and you're doing work that sometimes is hard. It's not necessarily pleasurable, but you're doing it for the family, for the group that you belong to. And there's less focus on individual happiness and, you know, I'm going to develop my personality and more, you know, I'm part of a group and I have responsibilities.
Yeah.
So yeah. I used to sit all the time in these high stakes negotiations. So the macros, you wouldn't see somebody be, you know, I don't like this plan, but you'd absolutely see because the micro expression precedes the thought process. It's completely involuntary or just a simple, we tighten our lips in anger, just a little bit of
it like quivers, you're saying, or you're saying it tightens in.
So it takes whatever. Okay. Yeah. So whatever, like people have different amounts of flesh here, right? It's either pink, more pinkish or more brown or darker, right? Depending on the pigment you have on your skin. But what you'll see is that part of the fleshy part of the lips will disappear.
Oh, interesting. So you mentioned both of them are the mouth. It's interesting. So is that kind of what you read for people that are harder to read? Is that the micro facial expression? Is that you have to look at the mouth if someone's eyes or forehead or not?
So I teach my clients in any high stakes situation, whether it be dating, you know, because love is high stakes, or whether it's business or anything in between, a parent talking to a child or a doctor talking to a patient or, you know, whatever it is. You're going to take this gaze. I'm kind of looking over here to see if my face is right. So tell me if I'm not looking at the camera in the right place.
You're good.
What I do is I dip my gaze. So I'm going to look at this part of your face because for me and the way I've taught my children and the way I teach my students, that's the easiest place to see the micro expressions. There's usually a top and a bottom part, But I find it just so much easier and more specific because my work is focused on where's the one place on the face that's unique to that emotion. So rather than you coding 10 different or 20 different pieces of the face and being like, okay, all these 20 different puzzle pieces fit together and this is anger. If you just see the lips tighten and the volume disappear. So with my lips, when I'm really angry, because I have very small, thin lips, the fleshy part will completely disappear.
Huh. And is that universal? Like,
yeah. But if your lower lip is wider than my lower lip. So when you're showing just a micro of anger, maybe 50% of the surface will disappear.
Yeah.
Whereas almost all of mine will disappear just because that's my baseline. That's my facial feature.
Why do we do that? Why do we move our mouths like that when we're angry or when
we clench everything? Our bowels, our fists, it's a clench.
Everything's and, like tightening, like our fists clenching.
Yeah. Mm. It's why when we're really angry, I get so excited I bump my head on the back of the like our neck and our shoulders. It's like how obsessed I am with my face. Our neck and our shoulders start aching and we get all like, you know, we can't poop when we're really angry and stressed. Like it just everything clenches and tightens and sort of stops the whole flow. Whereas when we're happy and relaxed, it's just everything kind of settles and moves.
Yeah, this is totally hypothetical, but it's interesting. I was thinking about like how the exposure of our mouths and kind of this lower part is found across superheroes and villain stories that we see from movies.
That's so interesting. Yeah, you're right. Where they have the mask and they still see this.
Yep. Robin, you know, all of these like characters versus like villains, you see Bane who has the mouth covered. Robbers, like bank robbers, they generally will have their mouths covered. Mm-hmm. It kind of seems like we've painted these people that have covered mouths as villains or people that maybe we can't read as villains.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
This is a theory, but I wonder if there's something to that, like something around exposing the mouth as good versus bad.
Well, and the other thing is that there's just, we could go on and we could sort of think about the masking in general. I mean, I think about the Joker who doesn't technically have a mask, but has the paint. And I talk about that all that time where that look of mental instability and really just craziness where we where we've lost all sense of predictability and boundaries. And that's got a piece of fear of the upper eyelids. We pull back our upper eyelids when we're experiencing fear. And, that's normal that we would do that. It's not an everyday thing that we hold that expression of fear. That's a problem. That can just be PTSD that we're not feeling okay, but it's a dissociative gaze. And so the real problem is when you, we haven't talked about joy, but joy is in the cheeks. It doesn't really have anything to do with what's going on with the mouth. When we're really happy, our cheeks lose gravity. And so again, you can look at all the different pieces in joy, or you can just say the evidence right here, which is if we're experiencing joy, this skin bulges out because it's generally pretty flat. And so I can give you a fake smile and see, like, I still got wrinkles because I'm 52 years old, right? I still got wrinkles, but you're going to watch the real. See that bulge? That's because my cheeks pop up. And when my cheeks really pop up, this normally fairly flat skin, again, depending on your age, but it will bulge out more than it normally does. And so that's in joy and arousal. And like, I like this. This is making me happy. This is good. So the problem is when we show that mental instability and some joy with it. Do you see how that like disrupts your whole nervous system? And it makes me so itchy. I always get wiggly after I show that facial expression because I almost want to like shake it out of me. But that's the Joker face.
I was, and the Joker is also, it's kind of like a mask because he's got his smile kind of painted through.
Right.
It's not
Which
really
is
his
so
real...
creepy with the like mentally unstable eyes.
Yep. Yep. Uh-huh. Yep. Exactly. Anyways, I thought that was fascinating, like understanding what is it about the mouths that exposes people. And it's also kind of why I like when, like, you know, when someone has a crow's feet on their eyes, like I just, for whatever reason, I have a bias towards liking them because I feel it's they've gotten it from like genuinely smiling. You know, you can't like smile, as you mentioned, without actually having some sort of wrinkle that
it
develops
engages
over there.
All those wrinkles. Well, the wrinkles for us humans show a lot of reliability. It's not just all trustworthiness and reliability. And you can see, I saw a woman who is, she's pretty mean. And she's gotten older and older and older. And I know her, you know, I've known her my whole life. And I was taken aback by how there were several individuals at this function, and some of them, the wrinkles had softened them, you know, just made them almost more tender, almost like you see your great grandmother and you have this wave of affection. And this particular woman almost looked like a wicked witch because her nasolabial furrow, like these disgust muscles, were so deeply etched in and nothing here. So it was like the anger muscles had gotten so deep in her. And I was thinking, oh, you know, it's like her character is etched into her skin. And if she doesn't relax a little bit, she's just going to be mad all the time. It was just, it was shocking how much the facial expressions that we make over and over again get etched into our skin, almost like water running through craters. Wow, and so that's probably why these muscles are evidence for your brain that this person has shown kindness and compassion and warmth. And so we feel safe.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it, right? It does kind of circle back to what you were saying around this idea that our mind or emotions affect our bodies. You know, in the end, you know, as we have these wrinkles. Curious to get your thoughts on this. So as a microfacial expression expert, one of the things that I was reading about is the Mona Lisa. And what's interesting about Mona Lisa is that Da Vinci was kind of introducing a new way to paint. And a lot of people have this debate about what expression the Mona Lisa was actually showing. I'm going to, for people that, you know, obviously aren't just listening to this, I'm going to pull up a picture of the Mona Lisa. Can you see this on your screen, Annie?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. So like in your perspective, just for people that are looking at this, what do you think in your mind is the expression that she's making, and what are some of the tells?
Okay, so this is easy peasy. And the first thing I would say is if you're looking at a facial expression and you don't know what it is, you mirror it, because that's how we're wired. We're wired to mirror each other's facial expressions. And we are actually programmed as a species to mirror and then send the same signals to our brain that she's sending to her brain. So if you see a really angry person or a really hateful person and you mirror that expression, your brain will tell you how that person feels. So she's doing this. And I can't do it perfectly because it's just such a deep, profound emotion. But even just doing it a little bit, she is doing what I call a knowing smile. And when I was taught micro expressions, I was taught that a one-sided smile was contempt. There's nothing contemptuous about this. It's only contempt if you add an element of disgust. She's doing what I call a knowing smile, and I sometimes actually call this the Mona Lisa smile. And it's the I have a secret.
Oh, interesting.
But because she's slightly lifting her cheeks, there's some warmth in that expression too. It's not, so watch the difference between I knew doing a knowing smile. So it's basically, it's not actually a smile. I'm taking the corner, one lip corner, and tucking it right along my teeth, deep into my cheek. And you see, it gives a little bit of a wrinkle right there.
Yeah.
A little bit more of a shadow on that one side than on the other side. And if I lift the cheek with it, watch. It's almost like a maternal, like, I know something. If I then add disgust, watch this, watch how it feels in your body.
Yeah.
And it feels sinister. That's contempt. She's not showing any contempt. She's showing the Mona Lisa smile, a lift of the inforbital triangle, little lift of the cheek, and a tuck of one lip corner, which is, I know something that I think you don't know I know.
Oh, interesting. So it's not melancholy, which what some people think is kind of the other half of the face.
Her smile bags are too big. There could be, it's possible. It's so, so slight. I'd have to see other pictures. Yeah. If there were melancholy, what there would be a slight rise of the inner eyebrows. And this skin, which she looks younger than I am, but this skin would come down. Do you see how that creates what I call a line of sorrow? A diagonal line, which kind of mirrors the eyebrow. There's just going to be a slight tint of the inner eyebrows where it'll be like almost puppy dog eyes. So it is possible that there's a tiny lift, but that's really hard to tell without her baseline. Because she's got smile bags, that's some joy. There is at least some joy and a lift of the infraorbital triangles, a lift of the cheeks that's actually pushing that skin to be fatter. Then if she weren't smiling, it would be flat. But you see that bulging of the apples of her cheeks are rising up, and that's creating, it's like throwing a rock in the water. There's both the moment of impact, and then there's the ripples. The smile bags are the ripples.
Interesting. I was watching a video. I'm going to just keep this video while we talk about this, but there was a FBI expert who talked about this idea of chirality. It's just kind of the asymmetry between when you break down someone's emotion. And he does this with like serial killers or psychopaths, basically, where it's those people are the hardest to read, harder than Asians. And when you break those people down in half, you have one side of the face telling you something maybe that's like concern or something that's like cold and then kind of the other half showing something else. And you can't see it when you see the whole face, but it's only when you break it down and study one part of the face individually to know what's really going on.
Because you're looking, because the facial expressions together. So I like to talk about it, and I believe I'm the only person I know of that talks about this. But I like to, it's almost like building Legos, the one Lego is one piece. So your vulnerability is on your chin. You take that soft grape and you turn it into a raisin.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you add the vulnerability and anger, that's hurt. Anger plus sadness equals hurt. I'm sad and I'm also angry and that's hurt. So you actually build sentences with the different pieces of the emotion. If you understand the main part of that emotion on the face of the micro expression, where that part is, anytime you have that pucker of the chin, unless you're using the chin muscles to get somewhere else, like the maybe face that we did at the beginning.
Yeah.
I have to actually squeeze them up to be able to pull this down. And so that would be an exception. So it is, I'm simplifying it so that we can start, you can get to more complex expressions and build on that. And there's more nuance, but exactly what that person was saying. And I didn't watch the clips, but from what you're saying, my interpretation would be, again, when we're looking at that piece of the eyes of fear, and then you add just a slight lift, that's the reason it makes it look like this is just scared. And you're not going to see Annie as a dangerous person. You're going to see Annie as a person who is experiencing fear. And so maybe you should be afraid too, but you're more afraid of what Annie's afraid of. Now watch Annie turn into the predator, which is so gross. All you need is a little lift, and that's the arousal or the joy or the delight in the horror. Now all of a sudden I'm not somebody who's the victim. I look like the perpetrator. Yep. And it's where there's that mismatch or something. Horror should not be accompanied by arousal. It just shouldn't. And I know there's some people unless you're on a roller coaster or something, right? And then
or you're a psychopath. So contextual.
Right. Yeah, or you're a psychopath. Yeah. You're enjoying people getting hurt. Then that's a problem. And our brains and our bodies know it when we see it to a certain degree. But if the person is saying the right words and it's in a context where we think we're going to get something emotionally or physically or financially out of it, we tend to disregard those red flags. And my wish is that I make it harder for people to ignore their guts when they can also put the scientific words on it, what they're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, this idea of psychopaths, just speaking around that, it seems that unless in hindsight you know what they've done, these people are so hard to read. So is there something in humans that are wired to have difficulty in reading deception in many ways?
Yeah, I think so. So there's a guy named the person I love the most about that does body language. I've never met him. A lot of people who hire me to speak have hired him. You know, he kind of on the same speaker circuit is Joe Navarro. So I'm so critical of people who write about body language because I've lived in so many places that I can almost always say, oh yeah, well, except if you're in Finland. And in Finland, that doesn't mean this, that means this. So body language varies from person to person, from individual to individual. And Joe Navarro writes about, he just never gets it wrong, which is just shocking to me. And he writes about it very differently than I do. But he writes about, you know, the disconnect and like, so for example, he writes about human beings touch their skin when they're nervous, but where they touch their skin is different. So like just that little adding of the qualifier of like where and how you touch your skin is the thing that's interesting. Yeah. So with psychopaths, and he writes, I believe he was the one that wrote about people are much more likely to believe the other person if they're emotionally or financially invested. It's like if we right. want it to be true, kind of like the spouse is the last to figure out the infidelity, even though all the signs were there. So we really don't want to know that. Or this business deal has so much sunk cost and this guy's been my business partner for 15 years. And if it works out, it's going to be so great. But like I keep losing money on it and it feels like something's changed and there's something off. We tend to believe a lot of times what we want to believe. We so want something to be true so we convince ourselves that it is true. And the micro expressions make they just add that additional layer of information that's invisible to most people. But for example, if somebody's saying, I'm so happy to be on your podcast, Sean, it's great to meet you. And they're showing the no face, they're showing the micro expressions of disgust. Your body's going to process that even if you haven't learned the micro expressions, you're going to feel like, wow, you know, Annie said all the right things, but there's just something off about her.
Yeah.
And that's your brain really processing it anyway. Yeah, she seemed nice in the beginning, but then.
Yeah. So when it comes to, you know, when it comes to microexpressions, like it's kind of the chicken and egg, right? So is it microexpressions that we use, let's say a smile that changes our emotions, or is it the emotions that dictate the microexpressions that we express? So because I've heard people just smile. If you were just to keep smiling and you know, force yourself to smile, it kind of does affect the way
it does,
you feel.
Right? So we used to play the smile game. I went to uni at in Lund in the south of Sweden. So I went to university and we lived away. They were dorm rooms, so we called them corridors because God forbid Swedes ever live like share a bedroom. They find that horrifying that you would share a bedroom with a stranger. So everybody's got their own rooms, but we share living room and kitchen. We call them corridors because, you know, there's a long hall and then we share the kitchen and stuff. But we used to play after exams, Glada leken, which is the glad game, the happy game. And one of the ways we would release our stress was to see who could smile the most aggressively for the longest time. And we'd go one, two, three, and we'd be like, you know, and we just like, we all do it at the same time. And one, it made you feel ridiculous because you're like forcing this, you know, you're almost like forcing your brain to take on more endorphins than it can manage. And two, it's just such a goofy thing. And you're watching everybody else make these expressions that have a bit, you know, a lot of stress and a lot of smiling. And it worked. And then the other thing they did at my university was they have the 11 o'clock howling at some of the dorms.
Oh my God.
And so at 11 o'clock during exams, somebody would open the window and they would just have this anxiety, what we call an ångestrop, anxiety scream, like scream out like from your gutter, like the deepest part of your belly, this wah! And then everybody else would join in like from like half a mile around.
Yeah,
like a pack of wolves. And it was the most, it just like this actual physical manifestation changed. And the other, so it got to the point where you could hear it in your sleep and you'd be like, that's the howl. But so yeah, that's a great point. We can change I notice when I'm when I start growling a lot, you know, I'm really displeased with something and I do this, I have to change my thought process or change the macro expressions that I can control. I can't stop myself from making the micros without changing what I'm thinking about or overruling it. If I'm feeling a lot of disgust, I can be like, I'm going to smile aggressively. And eventually it makes me feel so goofy. But the rising of the inforbital triangles absolutely sends a signal to your brain. It's one of the reasons Botox helps with depression. You can't send your, like this is, you can't use your ruminating muscles. And so your brain doesn't register the full extent of the problem.
Wait, are you serious? Botox actually helps with, is that proven? Is there research on that?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
It stops our ruminating muscles that Darwin called these. So Charles Darwin was one of the first people that systematically, and I, you know, he's got to have been on the spectrum, right? Because he's so brilliant and so good at categorizing. And I'm fascinated with the different structure of our brains. And I think we, as you know, certainly in the U.S. as a society don't, I know you're Canadian, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, in the U.S., we suck at really appreciating these beautiful differences in brain wiring. But Darwin took it upon himself after going tribe to tribe to tribe to tribe and not understanding languages to start categorizing facial expressions in humans, apes, and canines.
Canines.
And he just, canines. Yeah. And so, but he calls these, I believe he called them like our concentrating muscles. Right. And these are problem solving muscles. And Paul Ekman talks about these muscles too. And
what are they called again? Just for the audio list. Cause I know there's people that are listening only that are not going to understand this. So
this is our, okay. So when we furrow our brow.
Brows. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's that, you know, particularly women, but men are doing it too. They call the 11s. I have these deep, I call them my parentheses, but if I furrow my brow, so in other words, I'm taking my eyebrows and I'm using all the muscles in and around my forehead and above my eyes to like almost see if I really could try to take my eyebrows and put them, move them in towards my nose, what is this called in English? Nose bridge. And actually move them all the way down to the tip of my nose. If I could just move my eyebrows all the way down and then the two resulting lines on some people, it's one line on me. It's just two really clear vertical lines.
Yeah.
All of this movement of pulling our eyebrows in towards our nose and down towards our nose. Those are our thinking muscles. Those are our problem solving muscles. Those are our fixing muscles. We need to make that facial expression to fully ignite the problem solving areas of our brain. And if we're not able to move them, there's a piece that's missing. We're not able to problem solve as well. Now, men will come up to me all the time when I'm speaking. My wife says that. I said this on another podcast. My wife says I'm angry all the time. I'm not angry. And I'm like, okay, honey, are you? I love meeting these crabby men with like just cheerfulness, like almost like they're a kindergarten kid coming up and be like, I didn't get a snack and he got a snack. All right, honey, are you thinking about work? Yeah, I'm thinking about work. And I was like, all right, well, you tell your wife that if you're angry, your lips are going to be tight. But problem solving and fixing and dealing with a problem is the same in anger. The brow is the same in anger and in problem solving because something's unjust, needs to be solved, needs to be fixed. We need to engage our problem solving muscles, but it's only anger if our lips are tight. See how that feels different than this? Just this like, wait a second, like how am I going to, wait, I have to be there and I have to be there. It feels different, but because that is a piece of the problem solving, the parentheses on this space between our eyebrows is called our glabella, because that is a piece of anger, we often misinterpret it as this person is really mad.
Yeah, yeah. It's probably a common problem for most people. So to kind of break it down, like for people that want to become better at reading people, their micro expressions, you know, if you were just to kind of walk through a step-by-step like framework of where you would start. So probably I would guess like if you're far away from someone and you can't really see their face, you're going to want to pay attention to the body. And then you kind of have a closer look and you know, maybe they're not expressing so much here, and then you look at more of the mouth. Like, how would you break it down?
So we are so incredibly lucky because we have all this video accessible to us. So first of all, I should have mentioned when we talked about looking at the mouth and changing. So I always say to my students, look me on the face, not in the eyes. Because I want them to be aware of that whole, like all the muscle movement. And if you're looking at my eyes, your peripheral vision isn't developed enough so that you'll notice what's going on in the bottom of my face. Mine is, because this is what I do. But if you move your gaze down here, so watch me with the facial expression. I'm going to tighten my lips in anger. I'm going to pucker my chin in vulnerability. I'm going to give you a knowing smile. I'm going to show you some disgust. I'm going to show you some fear, which is like, oh crap, if we double booked this session, you probably wouldn't like, that actually makes the tendons of my neck jump. All of those things you see, but if you're looking me in the eyes, you miss. So one of the best ways is to watch TV or watch a politician that you know got caught lying and watch the YouTube clip and watch it over and over again. Freeze frame it, watch that facial expression. So I've put up kind of everywhere I can figure over TikTok and Insta and on my my webpage, anniesarnblad.com, I put up free videos showing the expressions and teaching the expressions because I've written these books, but it's all fine and dandy in a still picture. Your brain still doesn't quite register until you've seen it move. And then, the problem with watching somebody's mouth area for a sustained period of time, if you and I are face to face, is your brain is eventually going to tell you if I'm staring at your mouth that I want you to kiss me.
Yeah.
And that gets
awkward. Don't want to do that at a negotiation.
Right? But I've literally had clients where there's no romantic connection from either side, kind of tilt their head, look a little surprised and sort of lean towards me, almost like a magnetic. And it took me forever to realize when we learn language through immersion, we stare at somebody's mouth all the time. And they're like, at 16, I had all these boys kind of being like, well, whatever, she wants to kiss her.
You didn't say no, right?
You know, I didn't know what I was doing wrong.
Yeah.
So you can get away with 3 seconds at a time in a negotiation. So three seconds at a time, then you move back up your gaze and you just like, it's like basketball. You have to dribble and don't take that like directly so that you're going like up and down.
Yeah.
But when you get to an important part of the negotiation, move your face down. But you can watch a TV show over and over again. You can watch a romantic scene over and over again. Watch the male protagonist if he's in love with a woman and see if he puckers his chin. Because if he puckers the chin, the actor's really feeling that vulnerability. Or watch somebody confess to somebody. See if they actually have remorse. Are they showing vulnerability in their chin? We can watch those videos over and over. We can watch like the same 30-second clip 10 times in a row. That's how we learn language, right? This is just nonverbal language. So it's repetition. Yep. And once we've got the repetition, then we watch it on different faces. So different ages, genders, ethnicities, geographical locations. We watch it with, you know, a woman from Mongolia that is 97 years old and a Canadian baby who's 3 months old. Or we watch a compilation of babies eating lemons. So we get like 20 babies in a row going,
yeah.
Showing the ooh face and a little bit of fear.
My YouTube algorithm is going to be all that. I got to use an incognito.
It's
going to
be all messed up. Sorry about that.
That's interesting. I mean, it's very helpful because I've also heard, well, probably for obvious reasons, that like you don't want to look, you don't want to gauge someone's eye contact 100% of the time. It just gives us a very creepy vibe. So I've heard it's like 80% or so, but I always wondered like where to look. Cause like I have that in mind when I'm having a conversation, not to constantly look directly at someone's eyes. And I want somewhere else to look so that it's not awkward, but the mouth makes more sense. It's close enough to the eyes. And it also gives me some reading as well.
Right. And some rest. So with, I can often tell if somebody is on the spectrum, if somebody has autism, by the length of their gaze, because it's not as intuitive as the specific. So eye contact varies from culture to culture and from family to family. I do know several people who've been so well trained in their culture's eye contact with that when they go anywhere else, because they're doing the respectful eye contact, they get hit on constantly. Because you go to another culture where it's less eye contact and you're making three times the amount of eye contact, that person's like, wow, you're really into me.
Yeah.
So eye contact is really fiddly and not universal, other than it seems to me that most cultures do train some extent of eye contact when we're looking. But I mean, you know about Asia more than most people in Canada and the U.S.
Korea's the opposite.
Right? Yeah. And I've lived in Hong Kong, China, and Singapore, and there's all kinds of cultural norms with respect about how much you would show eye contact and look at somebody, especially somebody who's in a position of power. You wouldn't necessarily greet them and go into a business meeting with somebody that if you're less powerful, if your status is lower, and make massive amounts of eye contact, because that's pretty presumptuous. That's pretty complicated. You can, for those individuals who find eye contact overstimulating and still feel like in a business situation or even a social situation, it is expected, I teach my students to look at the glabella, because I can look at your glabella and feel less overwhelmed than the eye contact. For a lot of people they're receiving so many signals at once that it's just too much. And it helps them to focus on the words, which can be helpful sometimes.
Yeah, that's between the eyebrows for people that forgot.
Yeah, it's just right. If I'm looking at you, I mean, it's hard to tell on Zoom, but if I'm looking at your glabella, so this space where most of us don't have hair, right, between our eyebrows. Some people do. And so we put our gaze on that. The other person isn't normally going to register that you're not looking them in the eyes. But every culture has a different dance with how long we look at each other and then how long we're expected to look away. And it's a really fiddly thing, because if we look for too long, we're over-interested, maybe even romantically interested. And if we don't look enough, we're not interested. And so I think we all need to give each other some grace and try to be, as Ted Lasso would say, and as, so many have said before, curious, not judgmental is a really good line to live by. Be kind. Totally. It's not, we're all a little wonky.
What about arousal? How much of arousal is in the eyes versus what we can tell in the mouth?
Okay, so arousal is in the pupils. That's the easiest place to see. And your eyes are darker than mine, so my eyes are going to be easier. If we're sitting face-to-face in, across the table, and the lighting is fairly good and stable, because we all know that when it gets dark, my pupils are going to dilate, they're going to swell. And when it gets really, really bright out, so if we're sitting outside and having a picnic, and the sun comes out behind them, my pupils are going to contract.
Right.
So when we're talking about dilation of pupils in a business meeting or in a romantic setting, or even just like in a family setting. So dilation of pupils, it's almost like opening the door. Like you're opening the door wide and you're going, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me. And it can be for sex. It can be for money. It can be chocolate makes my pupils dilate. It can be for anything that I want and I feel greedy for and I want to get my grubby little hands on it right now. And so the really interesting thing is that if you're in a business pitch and you say something where the person's like, yeah, I want that, the pupils will go ding. And because it's so hard to see the swelling in the moment, it happens so fast. And we're making eye contact and we're looking away and making eye contact and looking away. It might dilate when we're not watching. So it's very rare to catch it in the moment it's dilating, unless you're in a really romantic situation and you say something like to get somebody really hot and bothered, then you can do it. So that's kind of fun. Right. Practice with that. you've got to know the person and trust the person. But I have a friend who does it with her dog and gets, and she says, she called me up and she's like, Annie, I'm doing this with my dog. And it turns out she's taking a picture of her dog and then she's going, tweet. And the dog's pupils go, whoop.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's the easiest place to see it. But you'll also see these smile bags and you'll also see like a half masting of the eyelids. The eyelids will like, if you think about closing the shades. So wherever your eye aperture normally is, it will just sink a little bit. It's a little harder to see that the pupil dilation is the biggest. And if somebody has very dark brown eyes, you're going to feel like they turn black. Like all of a sudden they went from brown to black, even if it's a little bit harder to see. I mean, I lived in Asia a long time. You get used to it, but it is, it's a
practice.
It's
more like practice for that one.
Yeah, practice. Yeah, it's like learning a dance move. You have to do it enough times on purpose until it becomes innate.
Mm. So arousal itself is a little bit trickier. It's more subtle to really.
Yeah, and go then into you're the going to watch all sorts of like grooming and body language, and you know it's a lot. There's a lot of mirroring that we talked about, both with the facial expression. It's going to feel like you're in sync. She moves forward, you move forward. She moves back, you move back. Somebody lifts up an arm and puts it over. The other one does it too. I have one man in my life that I put up my hand to self-soothe because I was nervous. I was anxious. And he had I had three fingers on my face. And I looked at him and he had two fingers. And I pulled one down and he pulled one down. And I said, oh, you mirror me down to my fingers. And he said, what does that mean? And I was like, that there's love.
You're
there's
in love
connection.
With me. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it means. Yeah.
Wow.
And that was like extreme. I'd never experienced that. Like down to my fingers. Are you kidding me?
Damn. I've heard this is a Hollywood thing. I don't know how true this is in real life, but when Hollywood actors are creating a love scene, and they're looking each other in the eyes and the camera is all face to them. Mm-hmm. One of the tricks that they do is they make a triangle movement with their eyes. It's very subtle, right? But it's what they're doing is they look at the right, they look at the glabella, I don't know how you say it. The eyebrows.
Glabella.
Yeah. And then you look at the left eye and then you look at the right eye and you're kind of like subtly moving. And the idea is supposed to like sparkle your eyes a little bit on camera. I don't know if this is true in real life or so, but
so it would make sense. So the reason behind, I've never heard that. That's really interesting. But the reason is that we track, babies track faces. They track, they're scanning. So if I'm looking at your face, I'm going to be going, you know, looking at your eyes, looking at your forehead, looking at, they're basically looking for all the muscle movement.
Yeah.
And we train them out of it. Look me in the eyes when you speak to me. Look me in the eyes when you speak to me. They stop doing it. When we are about to kiss somebody, we revert back to our primitive brain and we start tracking their whole face. So it wouldn't be this movement, but that's clearly what somebody is trying to simulate.
Right.
So what they really should be doing, if they're going to do it well, is just looking all over the face and really landing on that mouthpiece for a significant period of time. Because what our brains are trying to do, even with somebody that we feel really connected with, are you going to reject me? Because it is so vulnerable to tilt your head and lean in for that kiss. Your brain just really, really, can I just get some extra confirmation, please, that this is going to be accepted?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's so fascinating. So that's like a cheat trick to make it look like they're tracking. And kind of our brains know it when we recognize it, right? We're like, ooh, he really looks like he's in love. But we don't have the vocabulary for it.
It's tough. It's tough to, I mean, that's what you're here for. That's
what I'm here for. Yeah, my girls and I watch this all the time. We watch TV and we're like, oh, his pupils dilated. He's really that's a problem. He's married.
Boo, married. This idea of eye contact is interesting because, you know, obviously in the last couple of years, we are now having online meetings more than ever. And this idea of being side to side versus now looking directly at someone. And sometimes we have five people in a meeting and it's 99% of the setup is this, right? Some people have it set up like this, but 99% you're looking directly at someone. And I wonder how that impacts communications or relationships when most of the way we meet today and moving forward seems to be going more towards this 180 degrees where we're looking directly at each other. Is that good, you think, for communication? Is it harmful?
No. So I think, there's my knowing smile. I'm like, but if there's no joy in it, I'm kind of like, yeah, it's the problem, but what are you going to do? But yeah, I do know a thing or two about that. That's how you know I know something about this subject. So part of the problem is, one, if I'm like giving you the impression of eye contact, I'm actually looking at this little circle, the camera on my computer, and it and then I can't see you. So I feel totally switched off and I'm not going to mirror your facial expressions or your movements or anything. They're going to lose connection. But when I'm really looking at you, it gives this weird side view. So your brain, even if you are not thinking about mirroring as a concept, you feel like I'm not listening or paying attention. It's almost like if you and I were forced to have a business meeting and the only place we could sit would be side by side. And we'd both be frustrated and both kind of want to turn to look at each other, because there's certain things that are just so hardwired into us when it comes to connection. And yes, there are cultural differences in body language and eye contact and who speaks first or who speaks the longest, or whether or not we overlap our sentences when we speak, whether or not we interrupt each other, or how long. I mean, if you've ever been to Finland, the pauses for me are excruciating. Like,
why? Well, I don't know much about the culture there.
I'm going to get in so much trouble. So I had a client named Velle Kalle, and I'm such a linguist that my then ex-husband, who was, you know, we were living together at the time, he would come up behind me and be like, stop it. Because Velle Kalle would get on the phone and he would say, Annie, we need to talk about the development of the project. And I would say, because he was, you know, English was his second, and I'm such a linguist, I couldn't help it. I'd be like, yeah, we do.
You're mirroring him. Shows you like him.
Right? And so, and my ex would be like, stop it. He's going to be insulted because you're, and I'm like, I'm not doing it on purpose. I can't help it. I'm such a chameleon with my linguistically that I'd sink right into it. And sure. Then, but he, because he took such long, he'd be like, well, and I'm like dying. And then he'd finish the sentence. I think we should proceed. And I'd be like, I'm dead. Like, now I'm having an anxiety attack. It was so hard for me not to fill in the gap, you know, the spaces in between. And if you go to any like Italy or Portugal or Brazil, like they overlap there, you know, that's how they get the word. They take the word from the next person, start speaking. They have overlapping sentences. And so for me as an American, that's almost too much overlap in the sentences, but that's very cultural. So I don't know. I forgot the question. I lost myself.
Yeah. I mean, the pauses, it's also contextual in different situations. Like I know for interviews, the silence is the golden part, right? If you're having a deeper conversation.
Yeah.
But it's
I have a friend who's Cherokee, and I've been in negotiations with him. And he uses silence like there is no tomorrow. And for whatever reason, his silences for me are really comfortable, but they make other people really uncomfortable. So I just kind of settle in and I'm like, yeah, we're just going to wait. And it makes people so itchy. But it's a beautiful negotiation tactic.
Why are we so uncomfortable with these silence pauses?
I think it's a culturally wired thing. And, you know, even as you know, if you, a different family in Canada, you know, you could have your best friend's family in Canada and your family has a different range of silence than they do. So it can vary from person to person, even between siblings. It can vary from culture to culture. It can vary even within the same culture from family to family. But we have our norms. And when we're put in a different situation from that which we're socialized into, it's often a little itchy for us humans because we have these unspoken rules that we were taught to follow. And then when other people don't follow them, we get a little itchy. We get wiggly. And so, I don't know. I mean, you've lived in different places too, right? There's this, once you've lived in different places, you start to notice the pattern recognitions and you start to go, oh, this person's getting uncomfortable because of this. So I can either adjust and help them out, or if I'm in a high stakes negotiation, maybe use it to my advantage. But you've all of a sudden got some choices that you're consciously aware of. And I find that really interesting. I mean, you've got a brain like mine, right? You just the endless curiosity.
Yeah. You're not just kind of reacting to what you feel. You can observe, take a step back and say like, oh, this is what I feel. This is what's happening. And you can choose when to use that as a tool, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And then reprocess the situation afterwards. Like you like to unpack things. I like to unpack things afterwards. Like, what happened there? What was that? Or maybe ask questions to somebody else. This thing happened. What do you think?
Yeah. Last topic that I want to go into, and I know this is not really about micro expressions, but I want to talk a little bit about voice tones a bit, because obviously, you know, this is a podcast and people are, most of the people are hearing us. So I'm actually interested in like the differences of how we tonate our voices. Cause you know, I come from Canada also, and we always like to end our sentences like with a question, or we say hey, and it's always like an upper tone, and people think we're very nice. And you have on the other side, you know, Barack Obama, who his tone of voice itself is, you know, likely, you know, what makes him one of the greatest speakers. So talk to me a little bit about tones and
okay, so first of all, Barack Obama learned that. He didn't used to do that. And it's almost really? that minister, if you listen to Martin Luther King or you listen to an amazing, you know, minister, preacher, it's almost like I can't do it, but I have friends that can do it when they're talking. And it's this like rise of the, and they lower. I have a friend, again, someone that I sometimes negotiate with and that I've done, been on many works, that just lowers his voice. And when he talks like this, he can get, I can't do it exactly, but he can get anybody to do almost anything he tells them to do.
So a lower voice helps with negotiation?
You're softening your vocal cords. So I have a speaker's reel that I put up recently, and I have a clip that a client took for me, and I say, I'm an anthropologist. And you I cringe every time I hear it, because it was just at the beginning of my talk, and my vocal cords tighten up and I just sound kind of shrill. And I registered it as I was saying, and I was like, holy shit, I need to breathe and relax and speak from down here. Because when I speak from down here, it's what we naturally do when we're relaxed. So if we can get in this state where we're communicating with other people, which is our natural relaxed state. So if we're communicating with a family member that we feel really comfortable with, we would open our vocal cords and we would speak. There are other people that are much better at describing this, but like you, it's all the verbal, nonverbal little things are fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And so I can hear even on myself as soon as I tighten it all up. It's like, it's contagious, the nerves. So as soon as somebody slows down a little bit, not too slow, but slows down and speaks lower. And because that's our natural state when we're relaxed. So if I can be relaxed, then I make you more relaxed.
Got it. Got it. From a negotiation perspective, you're saying.
Yeah, and we're always looking for changes of baseline in terms of interpreting other people. So do you usually talk like this? And then all of a sudden you're like, well, everybody, thank you so much for coming. And you're kind of like, everything's short and choppy.
Yeah.
It's because we're forgetting to breathe.
Ah, right, right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah, that's very useful. Well, Annie, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and it's such an insightful conversation. We talked about so many different things. I feel like I don't even know where we
are. I know, and I feel like we could keep going. So thank you, Sean, for having me. And if you want to ever nerd out about languages, we could just go on. We could go on for a long time about that.
Absolutely. Well, I want to make sure people can actually find out more about you, your work, your books, all that stuff. So we'll definitely have the link down. Is there anything particular we should point to people right now for maybe those that aren't going to check the links?
Yeah, AnnieSarnblad.com. My last name is S-A-R-N-B-L-A-D. Yeah.
And try to pronounce it.
Seriously.
I had a difficult time.
Have a go. I promise that I might laugh a little bit and enjoy it. I think that just, the thing that would make me really happy is that if people would learn some of these skills, and there's skills that I put up available that are available for free on my website, on my Insta, on my TikTok, everything's on my name. And if they can learn a little bit, then my wish for them is that they use these skills to strengthen their gut, to kind of confirm what their gut is saying so that they can stay safe.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's a beautiful way to end it. Well, Annie, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you guys for tuning in. See you guys next time.
Thanks, everybody.